I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. President Obama made a surprise visit to Afghanistan last week to mark the one-year anniversary of the killing of Osama bin Laden, to rally the troops, sign a strategic partnership agreement with Afghan President Hamid Karzai, and to make a speech about the U.S. mission.
My fellow Americans, we've traveled through more than a decade under the dark cloud of war. Yet here, in the pre-dawn darkness of Afghanistan, we can see the light of a new day on the horizon. The Iraq war is over. The number of our troops in harm's way has been cut in half, and more will soon be coming home. We have a clear path to fulfill our mission in Afghanistan while delivering justice to Al-Qaeda.
23,000 American troops will leave after this summer, with more troops coming home over the next 2 years, when Mr. Obama said the Afghans will be responsible for the security of their country. A few hours after the president left, there was a suicide attack in Kabul. We asked two analysts we've interviewed separately about the war to join us together. Let me introduce them to you, both of whom join us by telephone. Andrew Bacevich is a professor of history and international relations at Boston University, a Vietnam veteran. He retired from the U.S. Army with the rank of colonel. He's editor most recently of The Short American Century, a postmortem. Wrote a book last year called The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism. And Andrew Bacevich, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you very much.
Also with us is Bing West. He's an assistant secretary. He served as assistant secretary of defense for international security affairs in the Reagan administration. He served in the Marine Infantry during the Vietnam War. Wrote the classic book about insurgency called The Village, his book last year called The Wrong War, Grit, Strategy, and the Way Out of Afghanistan. And Bing West, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty.
Let me quote something else from the president's speech, and he began by talking about signing this agreement and welcoming people as he spoke from Bagram Air Force Base. But Bing West, he said, over the last 3 years, the tide has turned. We broke the Taliban momentum. We built strong Afghan security forces. We devastated al-Qaeda leadership. Talking about the goal that he set to defeat al-Qaeda and denied a chance to rebuild is within reach. Do you share the president's optimism?
Fundamentally, about al-Qaeda, yes. But he was mixing two things there. Afghanistan's a separate issue. But if we do have on the defense of al-Qaeda in Pakistan and in Afghanistan, and al-Qaeda are the ones who attacked us at New York City. However, al-Qaeda has really dug in Yemen. So it's on balance, they're on the defense, but you just have to keep pressure on them, and I'm sure that our special operations forces intend to do so.
Well, let me turn to you, Andrew Bacevich, and it sounds like the president is saying our goal there is to defeat al-Qaeda, not to engage in nation building. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yes. I think over the course of a decade, the bar that defines success in Afghanistan has slipped ever lower, just as the bar defining success in Iraq slipped ever lower as that war dragged on and on. I think largely I agree with what Bing West just said about al-Qaeda, but the distinction here is that whereas the president is attempting to send a message that the decade of war is coming to an end, more accurately, the war against al-Qaeda is shifting to new terrain. Bing West mentioned Yemen. Somalia would be another example. So the war in which we are engaged probably is going to become somewhat smaller in terms of the number of forces committed, but the war continues.
Well, let me turn back to you, Bing West, and this was news from yesterday. I'm quoting from the New York Times, a senior al-Qaeda militant in Yemen linked to the deadly bombing of an American warship in 2000 was killed in an airstrike on Sunday, and apparently there was a release of an al-Qaeda video today. A seven-year-old man that's been held for almost a year pleading to the president to work on his release. How are we supposed to understand what al-Qaeda is today?
Excuse me for laughing that way, but we cannot. I mean, we cannot, number one, as Westerners and as Americans, and we cannot also because of the sound rationale for secrecy in what we're doing operationally, so that I wouldn't have a clue. I can say what's very interesting when you watch these attacks that doesn't get any attention is, all right, Al-Qaeda admitted we did kill one of their top operatives somewhere in Yemen. Well, we didn't do that just because we're up at 50,000 feet taking pictures. I think that the other part of the war that has gone, rightly so, unreported is that the CIA apparently has done one heck of a good job over the last decade of building up an amazing spy system on the ground that extends throughout Pakistan and Yemen. And manifestly, there's no way that Al-Qaeda has been able to stop this because these strikes take place in weird places. So there's something else going on here that has to have Al-Qaeda pretty badly shaken. I have heard that Al-Qaeda in Pakistan has put out to all their operatives that no three of them are together to go to an outdoor tea hut anywhere in the country. So they clearly are a little bit petrified by not just the Predator strikes, but by the spy network that is enabling us on the ground to target them.
Let me turn back to you, Andrew Bacevich. I'd be curious what you say in response to what Bing West just said.
Well, I think I probably disagree with Bing West just a little bit. Certainly I agree with him that this war that is ongoing in the shadows needs to stay in the shadows from the perspective of operational security. I'm a little bit troubled by the fact that war in the shadows is now becoming the American MO or the Pentagon's MO. And a war that's in the shadows is a war in which issues of accountability become exceedingly complex. And I'm not entirely comfortable with the prospect of the CIA and U.S. Special Operations Forces operating in who knows how many countries around the world when the American people basically are kept in the dark about what's going on.
Well, let me quote John Brennan, the chief counterterrorism advisor to President Obama, saying last Monday, the U.S. targets specific al-Qaeda terrorists, sometimes using remotely piloted aircraft. I guess that's another way of saying drones. Then he went on to say, in full accordance with the law to prevent attacks on the United States and to secure American lives. And I'll turn back to you, Andrew Bacevich. He seemed to be acknowledging that this is going on, but it sounds like you're saying some of these special operations, we don't know enough about what's going on in order to know.
We don't. I mean, what he was acknowledging was, I suppose, useful to have it acknowledged on the record, but he wasn't acknowledged anything that we didn't generally already understand was ongoing. And you know, you may want to trust the national security apparatus to be doing the right thing for the right reasons. But on the other hand, given the experience of the past decade or more, I'm not sure why you would want to blindly offer that trust. There have been too many things that have been misguided. There have been too many things with regard to the so-called war on terror that have been mismanaged that I think people should find it somewhat troubling that the war, as it continues, now becomes increasingly invisible.
Are you troubled by that, Bing West?
I agree with what Andrew is saying, but I think there's a safety catch there. That is, it is certainly true that if you place power in the hands of a small group of people who are determined, when you look at that Mr. Brennan, you can see a very determined man. And that same level of determination, clearly you would hope that there'd be some way that you could make sure that that is focused the right way. I think the interesting thing, though, is that we're talking about individual strikes, not anything on a tripwire that gets you into a major conflict. If you see what I'm trying to indicate, I think there is a safety catch there so that if it were going to, okay, the example, you go into Pakistan to get Osama bin Laden, and everyone now, regardless of where they are on the political spectrum, congratulate, for having done that. The issue then becomes, if that hadn't worked, if we had had a crash like we did in trying to rescue the hostages held in Iran in 1979, would the attitude be different? Would we be set back more? Probably so, but on balance, I'd say it was still the right thing to do because it was limited. I think there is a safety net that we do have there that these strikes will continue, and we won't understand what's going on here. But I don't think they'll get to the point where there's something that could provoke a large war.
Well, going back to you, Andrew Bacevich, the U.S. has been in Afghanistan for more than a decade now. Are there limits to what troops, soldiers, Marines on the ground can do to stabilize that country?
Well, yes. I mean, and Bing West is the guy who's got the on-the-ground experience in Afghanistan. So what he's going to offer on this is much more valuable than anything I can say. But I think the very fact that we've been in that country for over a decade now, I think maybe more specifically, recent facts. The paper this morning recorded yet another so-called green on blue casualty, and a member of the Afghan security forces shooting a member of NATO. We can no longer dismiss that tendency as just a handful of isolated incidents. It's a problem. And if we've been there for the past decade professing to build up those forces, to win hearts and minds, and we still find episodes of that type going on, then the likelihood of us ever achieving real mission accomplishment, I think, is very slim. And quite frankly, I think that the president and the people around him probably understand that. We are engaged in an effort to try to extricate ourselves from Afghanistan in a way that it will not be necessary for us to admit that we have failed. We can make this thing, we can put some lipstick on this pig. I think that's what the president is aiming to do for all kinds of political reasons, and I hope he succeeds, but this is not going to end up being a policy success for the United States.
And just, we're almost up in a break here, but Andrew Bacevich, you're saying that our mission in the U.S., in Afghanistan, a failure?
Well, it very much depends on how you define the mission. I do agree that over the course of a decade, we have seriously depleted the capacity of al-Qaeda in Afghanistan to operate. Of course, unfortunately, we've sort of dispersed al-Qaeda, and now we find it in places like Pakistan and Yemen. To the extent that our purposes were to prevent the Taliban from ever coming to power again, well, the jury is out on that, and we'll get that answer sometime after 2014 when we're gone.
And we'll get another answer from Bing West waiting in the wings. Andrew Bacevich, our guest today on Radio Times with Bing West, talking about U.S. policy in Afghanistan. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from Nemours, a national pediatric healthcare system. Through prevention, intervention, education, and research, Nemours has made a promise to help kids reach their full potential. This promise is lived out daily at Nemours Alfred I. DuPont Hospital for Children in Wilmington, Delaware, offering advanced inpatient and outpatient care in more than 30 specialties. The same specialty care is also available in communities throughout the region at the Nemours Children's Clinic. More information at Nemours.org.
Thanks to over 4,600 of our listeners who chose to become members during our recent spring membership campaign. Because of your interest in public media, WHYY continues to grow its market share, its revenue top lines, and positive net income. I'm WHYY CEO Bill Morazzo. You continue to inspire us to be the most trusted source of news and creative expression in the Delaware Valley. For this, I thank you.
Arcadia University supports WHYY and supports great teachers and education leaders. This summer, classes are available to start earning your certification, certificate, master's, or doctorate. Arcadia offers summer graduate education classes online at King of Prussia or Glenside. The world needs great teachers. Arcadia University Summer Programs. Classes now forming. Registration at arcadia.edu/master of education. Arcadia supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about some of the military options and challenges, diplomatic options and challenges facing the U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan. And we have two of what we consider to be some of the sharpest analysts of U.S. Military involvement there as guests today on Radio Times. Andrew Basevich, a retired Army colonel, professor of history and international relations at Boston University. And Bing West, he's an acclaimed military historian, Assistant Defense Secretary under President Reagan, and a Marine Infantry officer in Vietnam. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What do you think the U.S. should do? Bing West, you have spent a fair amount of time embedded with the U.S. Marines fighting in Afghanistan. From your perspective, how would you say the U.S. is doing in that country?
Well, I think that what Andrew said was an excellent summary. We have to divide doing what for what.
Right.
We went into Afghanistan in order to destroy al-Qaeda. We made an essential military mistake and allowed al-Qaeda to escape into Pakistan. But we then diverted the military mission, which at first had been very limited, into nation building. And we can't do that. I mean, there are 31 people in 31 million Afghans, 80% of whom are illiterate, who belong to 13 or 14 different tribes, all of whom are hurtling headlong into the 9th century. If I went today, or you went today to Nevada, and we drove out to an Apache reservation, and we said, Chief, we know that we agreed many years ago that you could have a separate nation here in the United States, but we'd like really to bring you in, and you will now become part of the democracy, and you will vote, and you'll be part of our Constitution, et cetera. And the chief would say, well, wait a minute, white man. You know, you won the war against us a long time ago, but you agreed to something, and we like the way things are. So thanks very much for your offer, but this is my reservation. This is where I live, and you're my guest here, and that's all you are. We went to Afghanistan, and after failing to get al-Qaeda, we turned to the entire country and said, we're going to make you Democrats with a small D, and we're going to take your country, and we're going to bring it into the 21st century, and we're going to give you economic development. And holy smokes, what an undertaking. I mean, we have trouble in some of our inner cities doing that, let alone doing it in Afghanistan, and we went too far. On the other hand, we did succeed in at least purging al-Qaeda inside Afghanistan. So I think Andrew is exactly right. The president is now responsibly just trying to get us out of there. And we did not succeed in nation building. And as Andrew said, none of us know how Afghanistan is going to turn out until we're not there doing it for them anymore. And that won't be until after 2015.
Well, Andrew Basevich, let me go back to you, and I guess some of the thinking, and I'm not here defending it, but just explaining it. The thinking that is that if you brought more democracy to Afghanistan, then you would prevent the return of al-Qaeda or even the Taliban or some of these forces that had intent to attack the United States. Does that make sense to you?
Well,
you have one without the other?
The logic is, I understand the logic. That is the logic of President George W. Bush's freedom agenda. I mean, the notion that this anti-American hatred that manifests itself in terrorist violence has deep origins, and the argument goes, the best way to eliminate the problem is to bring modernity, liberal values, democracy into the Islamic world. That was part of the rationale for the invasion of Iraq.
Right.
Iraq was going to become this beacon of democracy, and that the project would spread beyond that. The logic is, in some senses, it's deeply moving. It's very American in its ambition in the belief in the universal universality of American values. The problem is it doesn't work, and it doesn't work for many of the reasons that Bing West just articulated. That this is a Afghanistan is a exceedingly difficult place in which to undertake this modernization project, and then you got the other not inconsequential fact that we're running out of money. We have spent, if you take the Afghanistan war and the Iraq war together, we have committed something on the order of, you know, $4 or $5 trillion to a project, and we don't have that money laying around any longer. So simply from the point of view of being prudent in the use of our somewhat limited resources, it doesn't make any sense to continue to believe that we can transform Afghanistan in our own image.
And I was reading in preparation for the show that the U.S. has spent $634 billion since 2001 on the war in Afghanistan and currently spends $289 million a day. But to you, Bing West, the president reiterated this 2014 timetable in order to largely withdraw combat U.S. combat forces from Afghanistan. Are you saying withdraw and hope for the best?
Well, see, we do not know. I mean, the president was very elliptical. Manifestly, he's focused on getting reelected, and his speech told us nothing, absolutely nothing. And that is that our general over there, General Allen, has said that he will present to the president after the election his proposal for what happens next. And so we're just all on tenterhooks waiting until this thing happens. It is manifest we're getting out of there, but how much we're leaving behind, et cetera, I have no idea. But going to Andrew's point about the money, et cetera, and the huge cost in terms of our casualties, I mean, it just breaks my heart watching some of this stuff. Clearly, the path is down, significantly down. There is another thing that I think the audience the listeners should know about what's going on, and you both touched on it a little bit about some of our soldiers being killed by Afghan soldiers.
Yes.
I had not seen this in Vietnam, and I really hadn't seen it in Iraq. But I was out with some advisors and some Afghan soldiers in the middle of nowhere down south, and we had this small firefight, and then afterwards this man came driving right by our position on a motorcycle, but he didn't know that a few of the Afghan soldiers were outside in the countryside, and they grabbed him and they brought him in, and the Afghan lieutenant forgot that I was a reporter, and they began to slap the guy around, and all of a sudden one of the advisors said, no, you have this journalist here. And so they stopped, and they put this guy out in the middle of the sun and had him sitting there for the next 4 hours waiting to get picked up to be put to a brought back for questioning. And I turned to the Afghan lieutenant, and I said, I don't get it. You know, either he is a Taliban or he isn't. And the lieutenant said to me, oh, you don't understand. He said, they are such great liars, and they believe so much in their cause that even we don't know who they are. And I said, you mean that there are people around here and you honestly can't pick them out? He said, I absolutely cannot. And I thought, wow. So that's why you have some of these attacks by Afghan soldiers. The other Afghan soldiers don't even know that in their midst they have someone who is, if you will, one of their brothers or cousins, but he's on the other side, but they don't even know it. I mean, that is quite different than it was in Vietnam.
And Bing West, could it be possible that they are both, that sometimes they fight with the Taliban and sometimes they fight on the other side?
You find some who are venal and they will sell ammunition or something, but not physical fighters. No, the physical fighters are different. They're really tough guys. The physical fighters, I don't think, flip from one side to the other. They're either on one side or the other.
Does that tell us, though, that this is not a winnable war, Bing West?
Well, we can't win it. We can't. We might be able to help them, and advisors can show them technically what to do. But in the end, it's up to the Afghans. It really is. I mean, we can't sort this thing out. And, just to reiterate again what Andrew said, I really don't think anyone can predict what's going to happen internally in Afghanistan until after we're not there.
And that's Bing West, who joins us along with Andrew Bacevich. We are talking about U.S. Policy, the U.S. mission in Afghanistan, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Andrew Bacevich, let me turn back to you. And as we know and have seen the photograph of U.S. soldiers posing with some of the body parts of a dead Taliban, there was the American staff sergeant charged with killing 16 civilians. We know about multiple rotations of soldiers serving in Afghanistan. They did that in Iraq. Does this tell us that the U.S. military is stretched and that there's serious burnout causing some of these problems?
Well, we've known that the military is overstretched for years now. I think one of the things that's most troubling is the extent to which the American people, knowing that we've got soldiers going back for a third and fourth tour, are not particularly bothered by that reality. So what are we to make of this recent spate of incidents in which in one form or another we've got evidence of misconduct by U.S. troops? I think it's very difficult to tell whether or not this is indicative of a force that has proven remarkably durable, now may be coming to the end of its tether, or whether these are simply a bunch of incidents that don't amount to anything other than individual cases of misconduct. I do believe that it is imperative for the senior leadership to take this seriously. And quite frankly, I think it's past time for senior leaders themselves to be held accountable. Ever since the so-called war on terror began back in 2001, when something goes seriously awry out in the field, it's the sergeant, it's the lieutenant, it's the captain who ends up having their heads lopped off. And I believe it's time for us to see some more senior officers, up to including general officers, to be held accountable for an atmosphere in their realm of responsibility that allows these things to happen.
Do you agree with that, Bing West?
Two different things. I agree with that, yes, that we have sanctified generals, and we really shouldn't. We don't do them a favor by doing that, and we don't do ourselves a favor. They're like a corporate CEO in many ways, but they certainly enjoy much better press than corporate CEOs. And yet they all came out of a system, if you will. And we've had 16 general officers, 16 in charge in Iraq and Afghanistan, and every one of them has been a success. Now, come on, we've been there for a decade. Everyone was successful, and we're still there. What's going on here? There is the other aspect that I think is new about this war, these wars, though, and it pertains to events that both Andrew and I have seen on battlefields in the past. Anytime you have 100,000 troops out there, you're going to get incidents of inhumane or thoughtless conduct or something. It's just going to happen. They're still 19-year-old kids. But what's different now is that everyone has a digital camera. I mean, this is holy smokes. Can you imagine if everyone in college, when many of them do, make the mistake of posting things to Facebook, et cetera, and then they go in for the interview, and the interviewee for the job has looked at their Facebook and says, "What are you doing?" And this, in all fairness, has to drive the senior officers nuts, because I think there is a randomness to this. And the only thing that makes this different now than in the past, it can immediately, to use that terrible expression, go viral, so that millions of people are looking at something that some young kid did in a moment of dumbness, and now it's global. And that's because of technology, not because the human nature of the soldier has changed.
Andrew Bacevich, I'd be curious what you say in response to that.
Well, I think Bing West is right. I mean, and I would reinforce that it's not simply that because of technology, the evidence of misconduct quickly becomes available to everybody, but these are types of wars in which misconduct has implications that are more than moral. They are political. They make mission accomplishment, however loosely defined, that much more difficult to achieve. But I'll stick with the point I was trying to make. And I think actually Bing West reinforced my point. We've gone through one general after the next in these two wars, and very few of them have passed the baton, able to say, well, I've accomplished my mission, and yet they all go off into a glorious and well-funded retirement. The military profession in our country is committed to the proposition that a commander is responsible for everything that happens within that commander's jurisdiction. Somebody is responsible when we have soldiers smirking with body parts and thinking that's a joke. And I believe that you're never going to be able to have, at least minimize, the frequency of these kind of incidents unless you have senior commanders who understand that they are, in fact, being held accountable and are committed to minimizing the likelihood of these things happening. And that's not been the case over the past decade. As I said earlier, it's the sergeant, it's the captain, they pay the price, and the generals go scot-free.
Bing West, let me put something else to you that I was reading in preparation for the show. Something like 25% of the U.S. population still supports the war in Afghanistan. But I wonder whether even more problematic is that there are people that either don't know that we're at war there or haven't thought about it and maybe even don't care about the fact that we have soldiers, troops, Marines in Afghanistan.
I don't know. I mean, that's a tough one to really sort out. I feel that the American public as a whole, when they see somebody in uniform, there is something that clicks, and they do say thank you for your service. Now, maybe that's not enough, but at least compared to Vietnam, it's much more salutary, the atmosphere in America. And I think the Congress of the United States has been very magnanimous. And it's just time to begin to get out of there. But overall, I think the American public are sophisticated enough that they can hold the contrary thoughts. On the one hand, they may have doubts about the war. I really believe we shouldn't be there. But on the other hand, fundamentally say, look, we have to be responsible enough in what we do that we can't just say, oh, I quit. And at the same time say, boy, you know, those soldiers do a terrific job, and those soldiers are all volunteers. So compared to Vietnam, where the college kids were the spark of the opposition, because many of them were afraid to serve.
Well, you know what, Bing West, if you don't mind, hold on to
sure,
that thought, only
okay,
because
Monty,
we're up a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Bing West and Andrew Basevich about Afghanistan. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. On view May 11th through June 3rd, the 111th Annual Student Exhibition features over 1,000 works of art by PAFA's BFA, Certificate, and MFA students. The annual student exhibition showcases a diversity of style, combining traditional skill and contemporary vision. For details, 215-972-7600 or online at pafa.edu.
I'm Marty Moscowain.
I'm Terry Gross.
And I'm Dave Davies. Help WHYY celebrate 25 years of Radio Times and Fresh Air at a special live event.
Dave will ask the questions. Marty and I will have to answer them at the Suzanne Roberts Theater in Philadelphia.
It all happens Monday, June 4th at 7, and you can reserve your tickets at whyy.org/member experience.
Celebrate 25 years of public media's best, Radio Times and Fresh Air.
Abington Memorial Hospital supports WHYY and offers treatment for prostate cancer using the Calypso system. Miniature beacon transponders no larger than a grain of rice are implanted in the prostate, providing precise information on its location during radiation treatment. This procedure uses GPS technology for the body. Because radiation is delivered with accuracy, surrounding healthy tissue can be spared. 215-481-MALE to learn more. That's 215-481-MALE.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking about the war in Afghanistan, America's longest war, talking with Andrew Bacevich. He's a professor of history and international relations at Boston University, retired from the U.S. Army with the rank of colonel, served in the Vietnam War, editor most recently of The Short American Century, A Postmortem. Last year wrote a book called The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism. Bing West served as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs in the Reagan administration, served in the Marine Infantry in the Vietnam War, wrote the classic book on counterinsurgency called The Village, and his book last year called The Wrong War, Grit, Strategy, and the Way Out of Afghanistan. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Bing West, you were talking about your belief that the American people can hold contradictory thoughts in their head about this particular conflict.
Sure. On the one hand, they can have reservations about the war, but at the same time, they can understand that everything we do has to be done in a responsible manner. And I think, on balance, the American public have been terrific toward the soldiers.
And Andrew Bacevich, looking at this 2014 timetable, now the president negotiated this agreement with Hamid Karzai that there would be some investment and some presence, no military bases, he said, in Afghanistan. Does this 2014 timeline make sense to you?
Well, as we suggested earlier, I think that what happens after we leave is the big unknown, and actually is far more important than the question of when we leave. I think 2014 is a fairly arbitrary date, and frankly, I support that because I think that for some considerable time now, the war has been unnecessary and counterproductive. I mean, if not to get us off track, but I mean, we spend an hour talking about Afghanistan, and it's an important issue, but we barely make reference to what's going on in neighboring Pakistan, a country of far greater importance to us than Afghanistan, and one in which, to my mind, we are destabilizing as a result of our decade-long war in Afghanistan. So if the president says 2014 is when we're getting out, I'm for it. Be nice if it was sooner, but we need to end a war that is counterproductive.
Are you also talking about the raid that killed Osama bin Laden in Pakistan? Do you think that helped to destabilize this relationship?
Well, earlier Bing West made the commented that everybody across the spectrum supports that now that it turned out to be a success, and that is certainly a true statement. I myself would want to sort of attach an asterisk to that, though, because I think that I'm all in favor of having gotten bin Laden, obviously, but that's an example of how this move toward a war that occurs in secret, that we only get to see occasionally when the president or others wish us to see it, is a war that is being undertaken in ways with very little reference or consideration for adverse second-order consequences. Yes, of course it was good to take out bin Laden, but how did that act affect U.S. Pakistani relations? And it seems to me that the effect has been quite negative, and that has to be taken into account when we render judgment on the efficacy of the bin Laden raid.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation. Again, that phone number 1-888-477-9499. We are talking about the U.S. Mission, the war in Afghanistan. Again, Bing West and Andrew Bacevich, our guests. Let me see what John from Center City, Philadelphia has to say. And John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, guys. My question is in relation to something you both agreed in, that we won't know the consequences until we leave Afghanistan. Now, my question was, what is the worst possible scenario that could pan out once we do leave, and what do you guys think the United States' reaction will be to that? Thank you.
Thanks, John, for calling into Radio Times. Bing West, the worst-case scenario.
Well, I think, John, the worst case would be if the Taliban gets such momentum that they end up being in charge in Kabul and actually be the government in Afghanistan. But I give that probability very, very low. I'd say that's less than a 5% chance for the following reason. It's one thing to have a guerrilla movement out in the countryside where you're on motorcycles or you're walking. But the only way you can get to a major city is that you need vehicles, you need gas, you need heavy weapons. The way the Taliban took power in the early 90s was that Pakistan supplied them with everything. They gave them intelligence, they gave them tanks, they actually had MiGs for a while, I mean aircraft, and they had heavy artillery. Pakistan was 100% behind them. Pakistan is not going to give the Taliban overt aid that way. And we so control the skies. I mean, my goodness gracious, we honestly can read a license plate. That I don't think the Taliban taking over is the worst case. I because I don't see that happening. I do see the worst case of a chaotic civil war, and each tribe retreats back to its tribal boundaries. But I don't see al-Qaeda coming back into Afghanistan because they know we have that place pretty well mapped out. So the worst case I see is disintegration, but it doesn't really harm our critical national interests.
What do you see, Andrew Bacevich, as
well,
the worst case?
The worst case is if the Taliban takes over and then the Taliban would provide safe havens for al-Qaeda. In other words, revert to the circumstances that existed prior to 9/11. I think the likelihood of that happening is small, and I think that actually without us being there, we can make that likelihood smaller still by communicating very clearly to this Taliban government, should the Taliban gain control, that there will be the heaviest consequences to be paid if they allow al-Qaeda to come back in. You know, I have to say, I mean, it goes back to the larger point here is that our interests in Afghanistan are actually relatively minor. And that's one of the reasons why it is so unfortunate, to put it mildly, that we are investing the lives of young Americans there in such numbers, and that we are investing hundreds of billions of dollars in an effort to pacify the place. It just makes no strategic sense.
Well, and Andrew Bacevich, I've heard some people refer to the al-Qaeda, Taliban as organized crime, that we should treat it as if it were some kind of an organized crime syndicate as opposed to this enemy.
That's my view. I mean, we went down the wrong road after 9/11 when we accepted the Bush administration's depiction of al-Qaeda, or more broadly some sort of phenomenon of violent Islamic radicalism, as this all-powerful force that was likely to take over the entire greater Middle East unless we intervened. I think that from day one, we accepted an inflated definition of how large the threat is. There was a threat. There is a threat. It's not an existential threat, and it's not a threat to which we should respond by engaging in war from now until the cows come home, which, in fact, is what we've done.
Let me get Teresa from, looks like, Galloway, New Jersey, to join us on Radio Times. Teresa, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, the remark was made earlier by one of your guests that the generals were all reported to have performed well, yet we're still in Afghanistan. And I think there is no mystery as to what happened in that we took our eyes off our objective and went to war in Iraq. So I would say that the fault lies at a higher level than the generals, who were then given limited resources, and the whole swing went away from it, allowing the situation in Afghanistan to become much worse.
Well, Teresa, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me put that first to Bing West. Go ahead.
Well, I'm leaving in a few hours to go out to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. The Army had doctrine headquarters, where they're bringing in the Marines and the Army to revisit their doctrine for counterinsurgency. But my grave reservation was that on the very first page, this now was a military document, and it pertained to Afghanistan as well as Iraq. Mm-hmm. It said the mission of our soldiers and Marines is to be nation builders. Wow, I mean, I'm hoping I can persuade them a little bit that that was a step too far. So while I acknowledge, and I thought that the point that Andrew made was excellent about the spirit that I think transcended even the Bush administration, this belief that we could give liberty to others, caused this mismatch between resources, ambitions, and goals. But all that said, I cannot say that it was people outside the military. The military was perfectly willing to go along and say we could do nation building, and I think they have to change that.
Do you agree with that, Andrew Basevich?
Well, I mean, I agree with the caller in the sense that, and I did not mean to imply in suggesting that senior officers should be accountable that somehow civilian policymakers get off the hook. There was a fundamental error in judgment made when the United States turned away from Afghanistan and invaded Iraq. The Iraq decision certainly makes the top 10, if not the top 2, of the dumbest foreign policy decisions made since the founding of this republic. It had no justification whatsoever, and generals went along with that, but the ultimate responsibility for that bad decision lies with the commander-in-chief.
Let me get Lou from Medford, New Jersey, to join us on Radio Times. And Lou, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'd like to address one of the gentlemen who compared the generals to CEOs, et cetera, and implied that they walk off into the sunset with some kind of golden parachute or retirement. At a time when there's a move afoot to cut back on benefits and salary for the military, for individuals who put their lives on the line, who are away from their family for a year at times, and do not receive the kind of salary that this gentleman is implying, like a CEO who gets a golden parachute, makes multi-million dollars a year, never worries about having to come home at night that he's going to get killed, and is not away from his family. The benefits for the military should not be cut back. They should be increased.
Well, Lou, let me give our guests a chance to respond. And let me toss that first to you, Andrew Basevich.
Well, I myself know of no initiative that's trying to cut salaries and benefits for serving soldiers. There is a proposal in Congress to reduce health care benefits for people like me, that is to say, retired officers. But I don't know of anything where anybody's proposing to make cuts for what benefits active duty military people are receiving.
Well, and what I got from the two of you, and I'll put this to you, Bing West, which is that in terms of the golden parachute, that was more talking about commanders and people at high levels within the military as opposed to the troops on the ground.
Yes, and I actually agree with, I can't remember exactly how Bing West phrased it, but that we do have a sense of a cult of generalship, I think, in this country, in which there is an automatic deference paid to people who happen to be wearing 3 and 4 stars. We should treat these people with great respect. They are committing their lives to the service of their country, but that doesn't mean that somehow we should let them off the hook when performance is not does not meet expectations.
You both served in Vietnam, and to you, Andrew Basevich, and every war obviously is different. Vietnam, a generation or two ago, are there lessons from Vietnam that we either have or haven't learned in Afghanistan?
Oh, gracious.
Sorry.
I think so. Increasingly what I am struck by with regard to Vietnam is how quickly it has now, in essence, become a forgotten war. It was the war of my youth. It was a war that divided the country so sharply. It seemed to be a milestone in American history, after which everything would change. Now, as I reflect back on Vietnam, I'm struck by how little change it actually produced. and how little we learned in any number of fronts.
And to you, Bing West, same question. Lessons learned, not learned from Vietnam.
Well, let me broaden it this way, that what I am very impressed with, I'll put aside the generals, 83% of everyone who serves for America, and those who put their lives on the line, as you get older, they put you more in the rear, the people who are really most exposed, 83% of those joining today get out after 4 years. They have no pension, they have no benefits, and they have twice the unemployment rate. But what really impresses me is that we not only have sufficient volunteers, we have more than sufficient volunteers, and the standards of all the services are increasing, which means that somewhere in this nation, as a whole, we still have a spirit of sacrifice and a spirit of willing to be the tip of the spear. And that, you know, that is, I wouldn't be saying that about a lot of Western European countries. There's something still unique in the American spirit.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. We're so happy to have both of you together joining us on Radio Times. Bing West, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Andrew Basevich, thank you very much as well.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome. And I'll just give out the names of their two most recent books. I should also add that Andrew Basevich, editor of The Short American Century, a postmortem, his book that came out last year, The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism, and Bing West's book last year was The Wrong War, Grit, Strategy, and the Way Out of Afghanistan. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.